Greetings, kindred witches. Welcome to this episode of Atomic Witchcraft.
Here, we share our experiences as we build a modern-day inclusive witchcraft practice rooted in nature seasons, celestial cycles, and the science of energy.
Join us as we build a craft that learns from our past, is rooted in our present, and works toward building a better future, all while connecting deeply to the earth and sky around us.
Let us begin a new era of witchcraft. Hi everyone, I'm Ash, an atomic witch walking an eclectic road since the 90s.
I'm Alyssa, about 20 years in and growing a mostly green path.
And I'm Jay, new to the practice, composing a bard witch's craft. Because witch weaves together many webs, past, present, and future, we'd like to acknowledge that we are currently practicing our craft on the lands of the Coast Salish peoples, specifically the Duwamish, Muckleshoot, and Puyallup tribes.
The Atomic team participates in Real Rent, and we encourage you to engage with and contribute to similar programs in your area.
Welcome to our grove, here at the Atomic Hearth. Now, let's get witchy.
Welcome back to the Atomic Hearth. It's once again time for the full moon, and that means another full moon focus episode, where I'll be wrapping up my third topic of the year, familiars. In the first episode, we talked a bit about how to begin exploring the animal world and the things that can contribute to a witch's practice in general, and I shared how this is a total 101 topic for me, and the general approach I've begun to take to better understand and connect with all the lovely creatures of this world. Today, I will share how that journey really uniquely evolved and totally shifted my own expectations as I went along. I'm really excited to share all I learned with you, to share a bit of guidance for anyone who's interested in this topic as well. But before we get into all that, we'll first turn to the basics, as we do, and continue on our Witchcraft 101 journey that began in episode 145. This round, we look at a witch's altar, a versatile and meaningful hub for any practice.
While today's episode is going to pick up on our discussion around familiars, we also wanted to provide space each full moon to address the infamous "where do I begin?" question with witchcraft. Now, if you've been practicing a while, don't skip ahead just yet. Consider how revisiting the foundational techniques and questions for our practice can actually provide more context, layers, depth, and space. A bit of a refresh, reaffirmation moment, if you will. So we encourage everyone, no matter how long you've been practicing, to join us in re-exploring the foundations of our craft. Especially if you find yourself pressed for time, returning to the roots can be a great way to stay connected. This week, we're talking about altars, which by definition tend to be, a little dramatic and maybe a little churchy. The Webster Dictionary defines them as a place where sacrifices are made or incense is burned, or a raised platform used in the Catholic Church. However, in witchcraft, altars take on a bit of a different connotation. Here, altars offer and create a sacred space. By sacred, this doesn't have to be religious in any way, just that it's designated space set aside from your other spaces and that it is treated with a bit of respect. This means no tossing laundry or emptying your pockets onto your altar. It's also not meant to hold items just because someone said they should be on your altar. Instead, consider it a physical representation of your relationship with the witch within. Deeply personal and ideally inspirational. An altar is a place where you can set aside special items that are specific to you, your craft, and the purpose of the altar. That being said, altars take such a big variety of shapes, sizes, forms, and purposes. So we'll talk about some of the altar types and formats that we as a group have used, but let your imagination go wild here. Altars can take on specific meanings or be more general. They can last for a brief time, like a full moon or a specific spell, or last much longer, like a continual ancestral altar. They may be in reflection to a season, an element, a process, or whatever you need them to be. They can be indoor, outdoor, on a fancy table, tucked away on a shelf, perched on a mantelpiece, or even inside of a shoebox. You might have multiple altars, one of each of those. Or maybe you don't have a way to have a personal altar. You can rely on nature and community altars if you'd like to include them in your practice in a less obvious way. It's also important to consider the practical functionality of your altar. For instance, if you plan to burn candles, it will need to be a flat surface with good ventilation and enough room above for any flames to prevent fire. So think at least 24 inches, but further for anything more flammable. And remember that things like plastic and foam are very flammable, so like stuffed animals, curtains. On the flip side, a travel altar needs to be, well, portable, so its physical container might be a size that's appropriate. Consider things like Altoid tins and shoeboxes as some good ideas. Altars should always be focused on how it helps you to connect. That being said, if altars just make you feel weird and it's not a requirement, I would encourage still finding places or spaces that help you step outside the usual pace and flow of everyday life. Doing this creates a sense of ritual, and through ritual, we learn to make meaning and synthesize our journeys. Altars aside, you know, are there any other places in your life currently that help you connect with which? You know, it might be a small area of your garden that has a particular pool, or it might even just be a specific body of water. Altars, even as natural elements, can serve as a link to your practice, if that's how you practice. I have items on there that remind me of being much younger, certain trips, goals, and of course, my witchy tools. My altar has certainly grown and changed throughout my journey, though. Admittedly, however, I have had the same shelf unit for a very long time. Now that I was thinking about it, maybe even since the beginning of my journey. And honestly, that was kind of luck of the draw, right? It's a small wooden shelf. It's about belly button high on me. I'm 5'2", so it's not very tall. And it has two adjustable height shelves, plus the top of the unit and the bottom shelf. So it makes for four layers. I often use the bottom shelf to store supplies and books, while the top of the shelf serves as my active work and my most prominent display. Then the second layer is often my ancestor or memorial altar, and then the third shelf is a bit of a mix between ritual tools that I put on display, like my thame and wand, and things like oils and other sorts of tools, but that are more perishable tools, I guess. I also have a portable altar in my emergency backpack, knowing that in those times of crisis, it's important for me to have something that will keep me grounded. I also have my altar kind of outlined in my emergency plans, i.e. if I have to pack up and leave quickly, what absolutely must go and what could be left to the fates. Honestly, the fates sometimes have to have their selection and it can be heartbreaking, but it's just stuff. The connections we continue to make will be just as important. I also have an outdoor altar, means to honoring the changing of the seasons. It's in its first few seasons, so I'm still experimenting with what I want to include, somewhat for practical reasons like animals, but also really finding how I want to connect with it. It's the base of an ash tree right outside my kitchen windows, and it has a little nook, perfect for a small offering or decorative area. Cultivating an altar can take a while, but that's part of what makes them worth it. So I'm not the only one with an altar here at this space. Alyssa, Jay, I want to hear about your altars. You know, what do you use them for? What do you put on it to support that? So let's start with you. Tell us about your altar.
Yeah, my altar is actually the top of a small dresser. The dresser is a wooden one that I got from a friend. It's got a few different drawers in it. It was a little bit sad when I first got it, so I ended up putting a lot of love into cleaning it, lining the drawers and replacing missing hardware and repainting it, so it felt like a good place to have an altar.
What color is it?
It's two different shades of green, which Aww. Is classic me.
I love it.
We had a lot of leftover green paint from our walls in our rental right now, so I reused some of it. Because waste not, want not, right?
Yeah, that's beautiful.
The drawers currently hold fabric for my sewing project, so it's a little bit of a multifunctional. It's like craft on the bottom, witchcraft on the top, you know?
There's a lot of crossover between the two for you.
There's
a lot of crossover, period. We talked about this last time.
We've talked about it so much. But and then personally, my altar is a place to focus on my practice at. It's usually where my spell work happens, or at the very least, where it begins and ends. It's where I keep a lot of my tools, especially the ones that I use the most frequently. It's a place for me to burn incense and candles when I just kind of need that vibe, even if I'm not actively working on something. And, you know, I do card draws here, and it's just a space that serves as a constant reminder of my craft and who I am in this craft. Mm-hmm. It's that spot to, stop and take a breath and just connect in.
Yeah.
Now, I do have an outdoor altar that for the moment just serves a specific purpose. I use it mostly for spell work that I don't want the vibe of in the house.
Ooh, most, very nice. That's clever.
I do it for mostly Wittershin's work, like binding, banishing, and you know, some mild cursing of certain people in the government.
As yeah, one keep does. That out of the house. That does not belong
I don't
in
want
house.
That in the
yeah,
house,
it's also
but
not
I do
right
want to do
next
it.
Next to the house.
It's, exactly.
It's a distance
it's away. It's a little bit aside. This is a very temporary space, though, at the moment, and I really only engage with it when I want to do these kinds of workings. I do have one day like a vision to establish a really nice outdoor altar that becomes more of like a daily altar than a specific use altar. But I think I want to wait until we have like a really, really solid living situation, maybe buy a house or just like a multi-year rental to be able to execute that, because you know, you don't want to put that much effort into a rental that you're just going year by year in. So in the meantime, I'm going to put a little bit more love into my current temporary space, but visions for the future. And then what's on my daily altar that's inside, that's that drawer top, it sort of fluctuates with the seasons and my moods. But there are several consistent items that always stay there. So I always have an altar cloth, partially for decoration, partially to provide a nice surface and to protect the top of this dresser.
Mm-hmm.
I have this...
Yeah, it's amazing how dirty the top of altars get, especially if you're burning candles and wax and all that kind of stuff.
And all of... all of the ash from all of the incense that I always knock over.
All the time. Those are good reminders of like whatever you're going to put down. If you use like an altar cloth, there's a reason a lot of these come in dark colors. Just consider that. I mean, even if you use a white one, I've definitely ruined cloths because I've gotten red candle wax on it and it stains.
Mm-hmm. I've definitely burned holes into altar cloths before.
Okay, be careful. Fire safety.
Fire safety.
I'm so glad to hear this because I always felt like I was the only one who did this. And I need to have, you know, better aim as a witch.
No.
So I'm so glad we've all got these
messy.
Little singe holes.
It better get messy. I will say that, like, it is part of, it kind of feeds into that, like, got to take care of your altar, right? So, yes, you're going to make a mess at it, but you also have to take that time to connect with it and clean it up and kind of, you know, tend to the space. It's part of what makes it a sacred space is that perspective. Yes, we may get dirty, but we're also going to, like, repair it and return it to neutral.
Yeah. And besides an altar cloth, I always have this wooden disc that has like a carving of a pentacle and a crescent moon that lives in the center of the altar. And it serves as my focal point for any of my spell workings, or if I'm lighting a candle for someone, I'll put that candle on that space. It's like really the focus of where all my energy kind of goes. And then besides that, I have two candles that sit next to it, just like simple chime ones and simple ceramic holders. They serve so many purposes in my craft, from spell work to being the fire representation on my altar. I also have a lot of representations of the other elements. Small cauldron for water. Gotta have a cauldron, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
My incense holder and bell are there for air. I've got lots of little bits of lichen, dried herbs, dried mushrooms, and other flora that are there for earth. No surprises there. And then I also currently have my mortar and pestle on my altar. It wasn't a permanent fixture, but since using it in my smoke work, I think it will become more of that sort of focal point there. And then I also have a lot of bits and bobs that just make me happy, like some tiny little vases and a little wooden offering bowl and small pottery whimsical house and just some crystals I've collected over many, many years.
Oh, I love that. It sounds so beautiful. I too have lots of weird little bits and bobs. My top of my altar has, of course, those little mini candles. I have like a little bit of a center setup, and I am a sucker for like little bowls.
Mm-hmm.
So I will fill those bowls with salt, you know, just representations of different things. Sometimes I even just fill it, like I have an orchid plant that I really love. And so when the flowers fall off, I take them and put them kind of in the little offering bowl there.
Oh.
And I'm not really making an offering to anybody other than myself in some ways, but it's, you know, it's just like a place to hold collective items that I really like. A lot of people do money bowls. I do not. I actually have a coin stack that I keep, and that is how I do deal with like money on my altar. And so everybody's kind of got their own little thing. So Jay, tell us a little bit more about your altar.
I have a coin stack too for money, actually. Ooh. Funny enough,
I think we've ever talked about that. Is that just like something that we just happened to
That's it, honestly. That. Just kind of manifested their arcade tokens, but you know,
whatever,
they're gold coins. But yeah, my altar is also spread across the top surface of a shelf unit. This is a theme in our house. It's in my home office, which is nice as it gives me about like 3 feet of length to work with. It's a kind of a nice length of a unit. It's one of those 3x3 IKEA shelving units, like the nine cube set.
Yes.
so to speak. So it's about 3 feet in length and about a foot in depth. The space is covered with a long cloth, with an altar cloth centered upon that. It kind of gives a nice, like, two-layer look. And then there's a raised wooden platform in the middle of that that acts as that sort of centerpiece area, similar to the wooden disc that Alyssa described, although mine is more rectangular. And that's where my active spell work and key features tend to live. And as we do have two cats, I do love this location, as it's high up enough that it's, like, not an easy jump. They could totally do it if they were just in a huge jumping mood. But the thing is, there's nowhere to land. Okay. And at least for our cats, if there isn't an obvious landing pad, if they haven't made the jump before, or if they're not coming down from above, they're not going to try. Like, they'll look and go, nah, I can't do that, and just kind of quit.
Well, that's lucky, I think.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed they won't go for it so far. So I'm like, hopefully that continues. I do also keep my altar fairly well occupied, even with, like, spare decorations or two to accomplish that. So it's sort of, it's full.
And
it's bordered in some ways. But, you know, my altar is my magical workshop. It is that set-aside safe space where I both keep and use the tools of my craft. And I use this for laying out spellwork pieces that are being prepped that are currently in progress. I lay out the tools I'm actively accessing, so they're really easy in reach. So, for instance, I'm still dabbling with symbols and sigils a lot right now.
Yeah.
So my sketchbook and colored pencils are on there. And
oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Ready to grab. Not even in the box, because a color reference or a specific need want to organically just reach for it and grab it and then use it and not have to kind of, like, get the box out. Okay, here it is. And
yeah.
So, I could potentially keep these kinds of things and conduct these activities anywhere, like you said. But for me, that altar space is specifically located, set up, safe from cats in a way that's it's set aside from daily life, but it's easily accessible to me personally. And, you know, but in addition to being that workshop space, it's also a source of visual inspiration, reminders, affirmations that's really easily in view when I just need to glance and kind of get that thing.
Can be a good touchstone, right? Just even, especially if it's someplace that you go frequently, like your home office, or like for me, it's in my bedroom. I know some people like to put altars in very specific places in their homes, and that there is some meaning to that.
Yeah, kitchen witches will often have a kitchen altar.
Yeah. And honestly, a lot of my early spell work tied into my work life, tied into work things I was doing, relationships with my coworkers.
Well, then how appropriate.
Yeah. So there was immediate relevance. I could be in the middle of a meeting involved and look at my altar to the left, and it's not in the Google Meet call, yeah. So they don't know, but, like, it's really helpful.
Yeah, that touchstone, especially if you're working through shadow work or any sort of, like, you know, internal processes.
Yeah, so this is where I lay out my tarot spreads right across the front of the surface for that quick re-up of maybe the memory of when I drew those cards. I keep my elemental representations, seasonal elements there, similar to Alyssa. For channeling into related ideas while I'm working at my altar, but also for, like, if I'm feeling disconnected or overwhelmed by the doldrums of modern life. And so with just a mindful gaze, I'm brought back. I'm sort of reconnected with that moment. It's not always as easy as a quick glance and I'm there, but it's a good starting point.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also a great place to have meditation and all those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So talking about my elemental representations that live on my altar, they live on that little raised wooden platform that sits at the center.
Can I ask a little bit more about the raised wooden platform? Is it wood?
It's wood. It has a Celtic knot on the center of it. It's just a really nice design that I liked that I found an independent maker selling online. And I, at the time, I got it right at the start of when everything was beginning with my practice here.
That's wonderful.
Got it right from the start. And it's like just the right amount of size. It's maybe a foot in length and maybe 8 inches deep. So there's enough. You could put a couple things.
So you can put things in it? Under it?
Under it, which I have done a little bit of. If there's sort of a, I want something is working, but I kind of want it to be in the background.
Okay.
I will live it under the altar.
Oh, okay.
In that way. So yeah, I kind of like that it's got sort of two tiers.
Nice. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, talking about what those elemental representations are, they have evolved a little over the years, but it's always been a combination of crystals of the colors, which represent each element, And then usually an additional representation, which is sort of the interactive version of the element. So currently for air, I have a penny whistle.
I love this interactive.
For water, I have a glass chalice that is full of water that I refresh. If you have water on your altar, please refresh it regularly.
Yes, please.
Yeah, please don't let it get gross.
It's going to get funky.
It does get funky. This is true of spell jars or anything else that has water in it, friends. Water doesn't just like chill. It grows things.
And I don't drink this water
ever. But still,
it's... I also... The clarity of that water is a little bit of a direct cognate of just how actively I'm tending my altar lately.
That's also a good way to like help keep yourself, you know, tuned into that.
If that water's not clear, I need to do a little refresh. And
accountability through the chalice.
Seriously. Right, the chalice of clarity. For fire, a candle. Easy. And for earth, currently a sprig of lavender from our garden. But I'll rotate these sort of interactive representations in line with the seasons and or for moments of significance. So like air has been presented by a bubble wand.
Yeah.
A pinwheel.
It's my favorite. Pinwheels are also good.
Oh, yeah. A pipe of a bagpipe or a chanter, as it's called, or a feather. Earth has been a pumpkin, a pine cone, lichen, petrified wood, and so on. I kind of keep rotating. You know, in my practice personally, as you both know, the elements have kind of always played a starring role. And so these are really key features of dynamic significance on my altar. And then as for the rest of the space, like I said, I keep it pretty full. And so it's full of everything that's going on in my practice. So right now that includes the canvases for my creative project.
Oh, yeah.
That I've been working on, and their paints, and my sketchbook, and the colored pencils for the sigil work, my latest divination work via tarot. Is this all a bit crowded?
Yeah, who cares?
Yeah.
You bet it is, but it's a pretty accurate representation of my brain and my practice. And, you know, I say allow your space to reflect your magical self.
100%.
And practice whatever that means. So, you know, to be fair, there have been times when my altar has been really streamlined, organized, and minimalistic. Usually it tends to look that way after I've done some cleaning and reorganization, and I kind of like get a new general architectural flow to it, but then it, you know, pretty quickly over time gets crowded with just the reality of everything that's going on.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you could not catch me with a streamlined minimalistic. I have come to embrace the fact that in life I'm a maximalist person, in that I love bits and bobs and decoration for decoration's sake, and it is lovely and it is so fun.
Every time that I go minimalist, I am reminded how much I enjoy things and sensory engagement and just, and you know, so yeah, it never lasts very long.
I think from you were sitting in my blue space, you all know I'm not a minimalist, but not I do try to keep things organized. I do love visual layouts that are really appealing. So I do have a lot of little bits and bobs, and I have lots of, like I said, the bowl thing is real for me. I have a couple of them. And by bowl, I mean, I actually, one of them is a seashell that has just got a good little scoop in it that I filled with different representations of different things.
And I'll sometimes, just to add one more note on elemental references, sometimes I'll combine things into one item. So like something that's lived between water and earth for a time now is a sand dollar, or like something that lives between fire and air might live in that creativity realm. So I kind of play around with the cross corners, so to speak, of elements too.
That's nice.
Sometimes, but ultimately it's all about where have the elements intersected with what I'm doing, and how have they spoken to me in that season or in that moment? And it's on my altar to keep me tapped in.
Yeah, altars really offer us that unique opportunity to create a visual history and representation of our own journeys. So, listeners, how will you craft your altar?
In our previous episode, our new moon brew kicked off my familiar's journey. I shared the beginnings of my explorations into the world of animals around me and my early discoveries. Here in our full moon focus, I'll take you through how everything went through these lunar cycles. It was a lovely journey of learning, personal discovery, and it gave me a lot to take away into my practice. So with that, let's dive in.
Let's do it. I'm so excited.
So as a reminder from part one, this Familiars 101 topic means spending time to develop understanding of the creatures around you. This might look like selecting a species or two, then observing, learning about them to expand your knowledge about their needs, their habits, their habitats, the state of their species, and how to be a good steward for them. Even though I was starting from scratch, I knew that a few specific animals were meaningful to me in general: the wolf, the crow, and the deer. So on the first full moon, after doing some initial thinking and reading about all three, I used a full moon meditation to choose one of them so I could like hone in my scope and not try to learn about everything. As I mentioned last time, the experience outside my astral cabin home confirmed that any choice of the three was fine to make, and feeling a pull in one particular direction, I went with the deer. So practically speaking, this meant the Columbian black-tailed deer, a lovely species that's native to the Pacific Northwest and well populated here on our island home.
I can attest, they are beautiful deer. I got to see a few of them.
They're so pretty. And I grew up with white-tailed deer, but these are different. These are a subspecies off of like a red mule deer kind of offshoot from that. So their faces are a little different. And anyway,
they're smaller too, I've noticed.
They are, but in the, if you go a little more east into sort of the Rockies, kind of like northern and western central United States, they are big. They're quite a bit bigger. They're almost double the size of the ones we see, which is kind of wild to think about.
I wonder if it's because we live on an island. They've adapted to be small.
It's, there is discussion around, this might get really sciencey.
Oh my gosh. Go okay. Do it.
So there's the Sitka deer, which is a smaller red deer than the one we see that is more native to British Columbia and Canada. And then there's kind of this massive red deer, black-tail red deer, or red, like roe deer would be the more proper term, which is in that western United States, sort of central United States. And I would, I guess to compare, they really be more the size of elk.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
so that's big, more that size. Deer. Yeah, we're talking like...
Like the ones we saw in Ireland.
Yeah, that's probably much more of what we're talking about. So what we see, there's actually, as soon as I opened up any book about these deer, there's a lot of debate over what exactly are these deer.
Yeah, because like, are they a cross between...
Are they a species? Are they subsets of one or the other? Are they something in the middle? And that it's kind of, you know, you couldn't start into this topic without becoming just appreciative of the kind of science that naturalists do on a regular basis sort of think about these things and how to better serve these animals.
Absolutely.
So at that point that I had picked the deer, I spent some time talking with my grove a bit, as I did have one worry about this topic. I had appropriation on my mind, specifically thinking about the many local indigenous practices tied to the native animals of their land that we now live on. Yeah. Ultimately, all I wanted to do was do my own thing here, to observe these deer, to internalize and meditate on their characteristics and their presence in our local habitats, and incorporate into my practice what was meaningful to take away. That personalized approach was, of course, perfectly fine here. 100%. With no plan to copy or recreate any other traditions or methods, or use any language or ideas
and that's
weren't
really important.
Genuinely my own thoughts. Like, that's all I was bringing to the table
Yeah.
You know, hey, we humans have learned from the animals around us for basically as long as we've been around. So from there, my process followed this observe, internalize, and incorporate flow. Sort of one, two, three, observe, internalize, and incorporate through these three lunar cycles, with the goal being to hopefully build out my personal ideas around this species I was focusing on and incorporate these ideas into the actions, spell work, and rituals of my craft. And outside my craft, that my learning would evolve my mundane choices in stewardship for these deer. As a practical resource, I cracked open, for the second time in my life, Wild Signs and Star Paths by Tristan Gooley, to level up my observational skills and re-up on his amazing tips on the signs and signals to look for in nature, especially when it comes to animal behavior. I'm not going to...
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah, I'm not going to recap like the whole book here, and I don't want to
spoil
it. That'd
take a long time.
There's so much in it.
It is a little dense, but it's so good.
It's so worth it.
But I did want to call out a couple of like signals, things to look for, that these are just like some of the big ones that jumped out to me as I was watching these deer, and really even other animals too. The first was called, he calls the perch and sentinel. This refers to looking from high vantage points where prey and predators will watch from these to have the best possible visibility for differing reasons, of course. There are even some fairly formal proceedings here, including proper changing of the guard moments.
This is so good to learn, and I do see this a lot with birds, right?
Yeah. Chickens do it.
One step down, chickens
will pick a hen to watch overnight and then switch guard.
And in general, they provide helpful context from understanding the surrounding environment becomes clearer, such as where other activity may be occurring that's outside your own on-the-ground vision.
Yeah.
The second one he called the face and tail. This refers to the unique way that facial expressions, head position, and tail behavior help us interpret the moods and upcoming choices of any number of animals. Especially helpful with my deer focus, Tristan notes how deer will sometimes face something directly if they're curious, but turn to look side on if alarmed. And this may sound kind of counterintuitive because you'd think like, well, if danger's in that direction, why would I show it sort of my big side? Mm-hmm. But the side posture allows for a quicker getaway than if they have to turn.
You're looking already where you have to go, yeah.
Exactly. And then the third one I'll mention here, he called the stotting. This is the seemingly counterintuitive behavior which prey animals exhibit to signal to predators that, one, they've been spotted, like, I see you sneaking up on me, and two, that they won't be an easy catch and thus aren't worth their time. So for deer, this results in what some call pronking. What? So I love that word so much. Pronking.
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 Which is spelled exactly as you would imagine, is leaping into the air off all four legs at the same time and then bounding around with graceful joy.
I love this. What a joyous thing.
When having spotted a predator or threat, it's their way of showing just how lithe, graceful, and full of energy they are, none of which any predator wants to deal with if they can save their energy, especially after being spotted.
Yeah, because it takes away your element of surprise.
For any predator, it is all about energy conservation. They really need to go after only the easiest meals possible, and that's it, and rest as much as possible.
Well, that explains the humans thing so much.
It does, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And so I began my quest with these tips in hand and many others. My first chapter of this journey was via a trip we had to Port Townsend, Washington, for a couple of days, where I knew these deer were extra plentiful.
They're everywhere.
They, like, you can find them in the co-op. Like, they're just there.
They cross the street. Yeah, they look both ways before they cross the street. Yeah. Actually, it's incredible. We'd been there before, so we knew this. And it timed really nicely with the second new moon of my cycle. So I was like, awesome. First cycle, pick the animal. Second cycle, watch the animal. This was going to be easy. I spent time reading up on the species and I learned a couple of really cool things. I learned how safety oriented deer are.
I mean, you said they looked both ways before crossing the road.
Their behaviors are naturally very cautious and risk averse, which you may say, how is that possible? The deer keep running out of the road into my car. Unfortunately, deer also can be conditioned as to what is safe.
Yeah, most definitely.
So they can be conditioned to say, oh, humans are safe, oh, cars are safe, because maybe they walk around and they see cars that are stopped.
Yeah.
Or even if they're near roads and the cars don't hit them enough that they go, oh, I can make it.
Yeah.
And they learn. So I also learned how their legs are covered in unique glands for leaving specific scents, and each of them gives certain signals, like, between their toes, the back of their haunch, the front of the leg, and they'll rub specifically against something in a different area to leave a different signal for other animals or other deer. I learned how their browsing nature of their eating plays a hugely integral role in maintaining healthy forests, and how they shed their antlers every year, which provides calcium to the forest floor and to any animals who eat bones.
Yeah, chipmunks and squirrels will typically gnaw on antlers that have fallen to get that calcium boost before winter because their antlers fall in the fall time.
I did not know that.
Yep. There you go.
Dang.
And I also took a moment to chat with a local expert on Vashon, who hunts them in traditional ways taught to him by a former indigenous hunting expert, which was a fascinating conversation. So while on the trip and observing them, I took in the grace of their movements, including the stotting behavior, which they do sometimes just like for fun. There weren't predators around. Their protective family units and a sense of urgency came to mind for how these deer, they make their choices following the year's cycle, right? They need to be smart about where they're going to spend their time and how they're going to spend their time so as to not find themselves unprepared for the next season's arrival. There's kind of this, as I'm sure for any animal, a big clock of the year that's just going to keep on turning. And so this sense of presence in the moment, healthy urgency, cautious choice making, these are all specific behaviors I started to meditate on in this
moment. Yeah, what a good like reflection moment, even just for us, you know, as humans, of like, hey, what are we doing to like prepare for that next year, that next cycle? And not just like, what are our goals and what are we going to achieve? But like, actually, what are we building that will sustain us? Yeah. And not like just like, where are we trying to get to? It's not about an achievement, but like, what do we actually need to make sure that we feel safe and heard and seen and loved and all those kinds of things?
Yeah.
So cool.
So I did a tarot poll here after this meditation, because this was sort of, as I've mentioned on this podcast a couple of times, I couple my meditations with tarot basically 100% of the time. So I did a poll here as, to be honest, I was actually feeling kind of odd at this moment. It's hard to explain. It was hard to explain to myself, but I just felt like something wasn't quite right. This was like too easy,
okay,
or too formulaic or too something. Something just didn't feel quite right. And like, I had a lot of notes prepared and very specific behaviors and things to look for. Like I said, I grabbed them right from the book and I was looking for those things. And I just kept looking at my notebook and going, am I like, is this natural enough? Or is this too artificial? Am I being a little too...
formulaic?
Yeah,
formulaic. Well, but here's the thing. Science is a little bit formulaic, right? Yeah. Kind totally. Of approaching it from that way, right?
So, yeah, I didn't want to totally question it, but I thought, you know, I'm gonna pull some cards and meditate on this, and maybe I'll catch something I've been maybe not thinking about. I pulled three cards asking, is my plan meeting up with reality?
Okay.
I pulled the Hierophant. Teaching and teachers. And yeah. I thought, okay, cool. Yeah, this makes sense. Mm-hmm. They're teaching me. I'm being taught by Tristan Gooley and also this local Vashon expert. And cool, lots of teaching going on here.
Yes, yes.
This makes sense. Page of Cups, I had pulled, as you may recall, I mentioned that in the first full moon meditation I did on picking the choice. And I thought, yet again, new social contacts, are they talking about the animals? Or people. I think they're talking about animals.
I think they're talking about animals.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
Still nothing, no like curveball there. Then I pulled the Magician reversed, which kind of rang in my head of like, yeah, I think I'm thinking too hard.
You're thinking about it too hard, yeah.
Like, I think that really was all it was. I was getting really brainy about it.
Okay.
And although I was getting some behavioral lessons and kind of thoughts, it just felt very too nerdy.
Yeah, you got to connect. You got to take that and connect it back to the heart, right? Yeah. So that's that final.
So in these moments, I have started drawing from an oracle deck.
Okay.
And I haven't done it a lot. I think I've mentioned this once before. I pulled an oracle card as a part of my sigils work. Mm-hmm. I'm still getting to know this deck.
Yeah, it's very specific when it comes to oracles.
And it is a crow-based oracle deck, which I love. And it's from a local PNW maker of art and decks. And I drew an illusion card, which was in sort of the guidebook that comes with this deck, stated, you know, maybe you're clinging to a narrative rather than truth.
Okay.
Maybe you're hanging on to like the idea of something or what you want something to be rather than kind of just letting it happen.
Yeah, okay.
And listening.
Interesting.
And I felt the urge to pull a second card. And in my mind, I was kind of like, well, what if I kind of let go a little bit? And I pulled a card titled Soar.
Well,
which
that's not to just give me little chills.
Charge to say like, hey, have the confidence to fly. Go, just do it. Don't stop thinking so hard and just be out there. So, yeah, especially per that oracle card draw, you know, I felt the necessity to let myself go and be open to what the natural world wanted to show me. So as I watched toward the second full moon, I freed up my thinking a bit. I cut out the structure from my note-taking. I kind of just wanted to let dear observation be simpler and more open. And then suddenly, they just weren't around our house anymore.
Huh.
They just disappeared. And just then, and Alyssa was there for this, we heard a cry in our backyard, a certain particular bird cry. And it was a new cry we really didn't know. We just didn't recognize it exactly right. And thanks to the handy Merlin bird sounds app, bird
great
identification app, it's wonderful, we identified it was an owl fledgling cry.
Huh.
And not long after that, Mama showed up on one sunny afternoon, a huge, gorgeous barred owl that actually, for those in our Discord community, you have seen. We did post this too. Yep. Well, it's a little Bigfoot-esque, this quality of this photo, but like the owl is there. It's hard. She was settled deep in those branches.
She was gorgeous.
Swiftly and silently, she started just looming into sight and would alight on strong branches just underneath like shady coverage of foliage. And we got to watch time to time. I got to see her more because it was during my work day as she hunted around our property for her nearby owlet.
I love that baby owls are called owlets.
Owlets. There was Tristan Gooley's perch and sentinel right there.
Yeah.
And I was like, cool. Wow. That's wild. So I pulled back from one species. It gave me a bit of openness, which perhaps invited this new growth of one I had never even been thinking about owls. Yeah. I've always loved owls, but like that just wasn't on my short list up front. But I at this point, I was abandoning the short list. Why have a list?
Right? Toss it out the window.
There's so many animals out there. So now I shifted to the owl as my focus, and a totally unexpected turn and species. And so I observed, I read up on them, and the following points and traits started to land in my notebook. I wrote down opportunistic. These particular owls in particular are not majorly nocturnal. Not all owls are.
That's why Mama was out at 4 p.m.
And the barred owl in particular is a known day dweller. They are really opportunistic. They will stay up till they know they can be done. They have found the meal. They'll keep on working at it. And then they'll rest.
Interesting.
I wrote formidable because this owl is huge. I wrote provider. And also I wrote crossing layers of the wood. There was something really interesting of seeing one creature cross from like the canopy of a forest to the medium levels and down to the low, down to the ground and back up, this navigator of levels. I wrote observant, as they do have particularly large eyes, even for owls, to take in a lot of light and be very, very good hunters. The style of their wings actually silence their flight by design. Ooh. The way the feathers are shaped. I wrote fast, and I also wrote curious of people, because barred owls are also known for following people. That they not with malicious intent, but because they find them curious.
Speaking of barred owls and people, there is a park in West Seattle that currently a barred owl is roosting at and has been dive bombing people as it's been passing under its nest.
Oh no.
I mean, the different kind of opportunistic.
That's why you gotta put up a little sign that's like, leave little owl and
carry your umbrella with you folks.
Yeah.
So at the second full moon, I meditated again.
Okay.
And two lessons came forth, one from each animal. From the deer, I got urgency, constant cycle. Go where is wise. Act and move with grace. Don't overstay your welcome. Keep on moving. Keep on moving. For the owl, I meditated on opportunity striking. Go to what you need. Mm-hmm. Provide with intention. Move without noise.
That's good.
As the moon waned above, I started to think on how to connect ideas like these into my practice. Mm-hmm. The language of these lessons offers some words to connect with how I like to choose specific words for spell writing or rituals. But also I began to doodle a bit to reflect on what these concepts look like visually to one day connect with my sigil building. I also wanted to keep things light still. I felt that pull still to keep open to new ideas, new species, and I could focus on the practice incorporations during the final lunar phase of this topic.
Yeah.
So I've been talking a little while about this, so I have a question for you, my fair grove. These unexpected lessons by way of observation had been so delightful as to this point, and to me it really emphasized the value of mindfulness. Being open to receiving and learning.
Ah, core tenet right there.
So what's an unexpected lesson that has shown up for you, perhaps even recently? It could be familiars related, it could not be, but I'm just curious, what does that bring to mind?
Is it fair to say my whole journey in witchcraft?
Yes.
Yeah, totally.
Sometimes things just sort of fall together, and whether that is what you want to call fate or synchronicity or order out of chaos of the universe... Sometimes, just sometimes, things slip together, and I find that in those moments it's always an unexpected lesson. You know, most of my lessons do honestly come from nature, whether it's the observational aspect, the experience, or the unseen science of it all. The process and systems consistently offer me new perspectives on where to look and go next. Little guideposts that are there, gently pointing the way. But you have to be pretty tuned in to feel that nuance. Mm-hmm. Like you were saying, that mindfulness really comes to key.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to make changes like you did here, right? Knowing when to pivot can be really key to finding that unexpected lesson and kind of going on that journey. If you hold really rigid, you don't allow for that unexpected lesson. You have to take risk.
Yeah, you've got to be kind of a little bit loose when it comes to witchcraft and learning from these lessons. You can't be like, no, I'm going to stay the course. Because then either A, things will go wrong, or B, you don't learn the lesson that you actually need to learn.
Yeah.
But
you'll be forced to learn it in a much more abrupt way. Let me tell you, the universe will teach you the lesson. You get to choose when that lesson manifests for you. But, you know, so sometimes you just got to take the little hit so you can avoid the big hit sometimes, but also, you know, take that small pivot because it might reveal the big pivot that's just around the corner that you're looking for.
My mom used to always say that, like, you know, the universe will send you hints if you need to redirect. It'll start with like a soft like bap from a pillow, and then it'll hit you with a brick wall if you don't pay attention.
100%. At least in my experience. I mean, it's everybody's experience too. Is different.
Oh my god. But I mean, like, I'm exactly where you are on this, and that kind of describes my witchcraft journey as a whole. I think of a lot of my unexpected lessons were like that, oh snap, I didn't think that would happen kind of lessons, or the I really should have picked my words better here type lessons, you know, the be careful what you wish for way of learning.
Yeah.
But I also think finding lessons in conversations with unexpected people sometimes, i.e. those I didn't think I would end up getting any insight into witchcraft from, or like weird contexts, like conversations in theater with other actors.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I'm also with you on getting these moments and these lessons from nature, observation. I think that as witches, we tend to just naturally want to be more open to what's around us than most other folks. And so we notice these like little flashes of learning a little bit easier, like, you know, pre-brick wall.
Well, and I think sometimes people are like, oh, you know, how are witches intuitive? What is that? You know, and we talk about weaving and looking forward. It's a lot of that. If you are paying attention to life, you're paying attention to your movement through life and how you move and how life interacts with you, right? It offers this opportunity to really kind of get ahead. You start to see the signs, so to speak, before they become so obvious that it's an actual redirection.
You know, and I've definitely surprised people with being like, where they're like, oh, I don't know what this is. And I'll like, oh, it's X, Y, and Z. And they're like, how did you realize that? I'm like, I observed.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. Like, this has like definitely become a part of my like regular life, quote unquote, practice, as well as my witchcraft practice is.
It's the same thing, friends.
It's the same thing.
Real life and witchcraft, same thing.
It's mindfulness, observation, knowing, being open. It's all those things. It just makes you so much more mindful in your practice and outside of your practice.
And to be clear and worth saying, because this is definitely the theme of what I took away here, is like looking around and noticing things doesn't necessarily mean you're being mindful if you are coding everything in your own confirmation bias.
100%.
Oh, and that's what I was doing.
Oh, yeah.
Where I went, I know what I'm looking for. I know about, I grew up around deer. They jump around, they run, for, you know, this and that. And like, I was losing all the nuance. And so to be mindful is to be mindful with a assumption that you don't know.
The self-awareness part of this, you know, when we talk about meditation, mindfulness, and self-awareness, that is why self-awareness is part of that trifecta, because without that, you're right, mindfulness it doesn't just mean being present in the moment. It's also the self-awareness that comes with your role in that and your impact and how you're showing up and your lens, all that.
It's all connected, folks. It's all connected.
Now, speaking of self-awareness, now back to me. Sorry, old dated joke there. Jokes aside, let's jump in here at the crest of my third new moon.
All right, here we go. The last lunar cycle.
We're doing it.
I really liked how this model of observe, internalize, incorporate provided just enough structure to follow without providing too many guardrails.
Woo, that's what we want, framework.
I also wanted to take, I knew you'd like that. I also wanted to take a second to check Sagittarius here, but I've learned from Virgo. to take a second to check on any adjustments I might make. So I did a new moon meditation, super odd for me.
Okay.
But
breaking up the formula. I'm
pretty much full moon meditation, dude, but I was feeling open-minded. So
oh, look at you. Hey, look at that.
I could meditate any day. I asked, what lessons have I reaped so far in this journey? Kind of generic, but yeah, I do like to do this sometimes because I feel like I get to pick up on some currents that are just in the back of my mind.
Nothing wrong with generic, plus it's a really good open-ended could go anywhere, right? You're not you're not like pigeonholing the answer in the question. So
I got some interesting cards. I pulled the Chariot reversed. Not finished yet.
Yeah, that's a journey undone.
Which I knew it wasn't. But I was like, all right, a little on the nose, but fine. Queen of Wands, which was actually, that was an upfront one with the new moon pull as well. Didn't surprise me. Careful, mindful leadership. Two of Swords, indecision. And I was curious where that would go. I did realize that kind of made me think about, yes, I'm learning a lot. I haven't really decided what I'm going to do with it yet. Exactly. So I'm in a place where I've gathered a lot of data and I haven't, I don't know what decisions I'm making with that data yet. Right.
Yeah,
so I was like, okay, that's maybe a good lesson of learning is great, but application is where you make it real.
Yep.
And then I pulled an oracle card as to see if there was kind of a theme in this moment. And I pulled the Knight card, which was about making space for quiet and stillness and also rest. And I thought that too. Either one, I was going to meet new creatures at night.
Okay.
Very possible.
Possible,
Or this was a really busy time in my life as I pulled this card especially, and I thought, yeah, I might be burning too many candles at every end right now. So
yeah.
If I slow down a little bit, that might also give me a little openness in this moment.
And, yeah, especially in regards to the indecision and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So in my third lunar round here, two more species popped up.
Well, that's not less candles.
Offering even more lessons to appreciate right around our home. First, dark-eyed juncos. For those who don't know the name, these are a lovely little type of sparrow, and they've always been around our house. But honestly, little birds have never truly caught my eye until Carl.
Oh, Carl.
Here's how I met Carl. And again, our Discord friends, they've met Carl. I was eating lunch one day, and I saw a small bird, smaller than these types of birds usually are that I've seen around our deck all the time, jump up onto the table on our back deck. He looked at me quite intently through the window, silently tilting his head, and then he began to scream, making direct eye contact with me, like into my soul. And I was like, friend, I don't know. I can't feed you this. This is my sandwich. Maybe I could share. And it wasn't long before his parents came by and began feeding him, grabbing little bits of food from our feeder and feeding it right to his mouth. And so began a few weeks of every day watching this amazing little fledgling grow, learn to forage, and learn to fly. I learned from both him and his parents in the community around him of an array of bird species, which love to frequent our always filled feeder.
Until the nuthatch kicks all the seeds out because it wants to find a specific seed.
Yeah, that nuthatch really is a little
rude.
Too picky. and so messy. And another sign from the book popped up here, the cacophony. This is the collective of these feathered eaters. They were constantly amidst their eating and flitting around, sending messages, communicating to the group in countless ways to each other about food, about potential threats, about where are we going to go next. And as I read more about these lovely juncos, my notebook received the following notes. Patient, the parents, specifically the parents.
Yeah.
Instructive.
Also the parents.
Competitive, persistent, stable group structures, always the same amount of birds. Always coming back, occasionally inviting more, but like really stable rhythms. Playful and fallen leaves, as leaves would arrive on our deck. Sometimes there wouldn't be any food left. They'd still come back to the deck and just bounce around in the crunkly leaves. And by the way, if that's not cute enough, a group of juncos is called a blizzard.
Aww, a blizzard of juncos.
Why does it? Why, they're not a flock. They're just like other birds. They get to be a blizzard?
They are a flock, but the specific word they get is blizzard. And so just as the third full moon was climbing high, just as I thought I'd met my third and final animal for this topic, our sleep was interrupted one night, that night oracle card, by one more particularly vocal species, coyotes.
Oh, wow.
At about 2 in the morning, we were jolted awake by the sounds of yipping and howling that were so loud, honestly, I thought they were in the bedroom. These canines were singing in celebration. They clearly had found and conquered some source of food, and their young ones were trying out their voices.
It was very baby yippy sounds.
Oh, yeah. They honestly timed it nicely to right when my community chorale rehearsals were starting again for the season. So, like, well-timed, guys.
Community howling.
Mm-hmm. I've always loved wolves, but I realized I knew very little about coyotes, even though, like, I've been living somewhere with the presence of coyotes my entire life. Rural Pennsylvania, Southern California, the Pacific Northwest, different kinds. But coyotes are in a lot of places in this country, in America. And so, you know, yeah, they weren't a species I could easily observe during the day, yeah. So I had to focus on reading. And I learned how incredibly adaptive and intelligent they are. I learned how coyotes use vocalizations for a wide array of purposes. Everything from pure joy and fun to very specific growls and yips to spread information quickly amongst a group or across a large area. That's also why they howl up, to really increase the echo. They want to really have a lot of range on what they're saying. I also learned how they've taken over forests like ours, mostly directly as a result of the reduction of gray wolf population.
Oh, interesting.
They've been eliminated and moved around. The coyotes have moved in. You know, this is an example of how even, you know, when we humans choose to do the opposite of stewardship and we make our own human focused choices, nature adapts and writes their song anew. So on this third full moon, my last meditation, I asked the question, overall, what should I take forward with me here? I learned so much about four different species. I certainly felt a pull to keep learning and growing. And so I went again to my astral cabin home and sat on my porch to open myself up to the things to carry along my way from here. When I got into this meditation, I found myself walking through the woods to the cabin at twilight. I've never come into my astral home and forest at that time of day.
Interesting.
When I sat on the step, no animals had come by at first, and I was looking out to the, you know, the dimming indigo of the sky, and I felt a little nudge at my hip, like my left side. Never have I seen this, but there was Lily, one of our two cats.
Aww.
on the astral with me.
Yeah.
Never joined me there. She doesn't even like when I do spell work. She heads away from my office. So this was really special. Then a huge antlered stag appeared and beckoned me to turn around and head inside. Inside the door, which always opens to a long table with chairs around it, the floor was being replaced by grass and the table was covered in moss. And bees and birds danced throughout my house in coordinated delight. I felt the next step was diving into the connections among the world of familiars, seeing myself as a part of them, not separate, and only as an observer. So then I pulled some tarot, and I meant to pull three cards, but sometimes as I'm pulling them, I'm told, nah, just one.
Yeah.
Nah, just two. So okay. It turned out to be two. So I pulled the Eight of Cups, looking to learn and dig into something on a much deeper level, and the Magician upright, putting across your message to a much wider audience.
And here we are.
So, you know, the notes that I took throughout this experience, these have provided me this, like, library of words, phrases, and ideas that I can now use to connect my impressions to my work. You know, I've continued to doodle to turn this language into imagery. That's allowed my sketchbook to continue to flourish with new ideas and symbols, and that they could be used to create sigils for my practice. And on the stewardship side, I'm encouraged to share, you know, what I've learned with my friends, my community, like I am now, so we can all be mindful about how amazing these creatures are. And, you know, practically, my takeaways are making a point to drive safely with deer in mind, especially in the fall rutting season.
Oh, okay.
If you're not sure what rutting is, I'm not going to do it. That'll be a whole other segment in this episode. But please Google rutting.
They're just very active during that season.
Yeah, it's the competitive moment of male deer, and they get a little reckless. You know, allowing for more of our property to kind of rewild a little bit. And we definitely already tend to do this, but, you know, just realizing that browsing behavior of many animals is such a healthy and important piece of the particular ecosystem in which we live. And also so that, you know, hunting animals can find some more cover and, you know, do their thing.
Yep.
So, you know, will I continue to incorporate familiars into my practice? Continue this wonderful learning? No, this clearly wasn't for me. Yeah, obviously, this was great. This was such a delightful topic.
I was going to say that the astral home opening up to essentially converting to a natural outdoor space.
Boring. Yeah, no, it was so great. And you know, I know I'm sure you have more questions for me other than will I keep doing this? Because that's an obvious one. So have at it. What do you have for me?
I love that pulling away from this like solo laser focus on deer allowed you to have like so many other experiences and lessons with our local fauna. Now, you mentioned that you are still interested in this. So do you plan on continuing to like really lean into a familiar aspect in your path, maybe incorporate it more into an everyday sort of aspect? Or are you going to kind of simmer it on the back burner for a little bit? What do you think?
Yeah, I definitely do plan to keep leaning in. By the end of this topic's three lunar cycles, I honestly was having trouble keeping up with all I was beginning to notice and appreciate about all the various creatures in my orbit. Oh, that just came to me. That's the indecision card.
They always come around.
Keep on coming. I honestly would love to spend a whole year.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is really one of those topics that could easily be.
Just allowing familiars to teach me things, right? Like, that just sounds so cool.
Oh, so maybe a yearly topic for next year.
Maybe.
We haven't picked that yet.
It's a little Walden-like, right?
Very much so.
I think this is going to be an always on the back burner sort of topic, like ever present. And so a year-long topic, I think that's actually a great way to kind of treat it in that way. Mm-hmm. And I'll move it up front when I'm feeling the need to make it the primary focus of a season.
Yeah.
So in that, we also talked about being a steward to the deer. You know, you mentioned, i.e. like driving mindfully and allowing things to grow for them to graze. You know, do you have any aspirations or ideas on being a steward to some of the critters that you mentioned?
Driving thing is big. Just in general, being mindful of how dramatically we humans both have changed and currently shape the lives and choices of so many species who were in these places before we ever were. So on that note, I'd say two things come to mind in terms of stewardship choices. The first is like getting more involved in lobbying and efforts which foster properly restoring and cultivating native habitats. Mm-hmm. This could be as simple as knowing about local elections for positions which affect things like these budgets and these efforts.
The barred owl is a really big hot topic right now. Yeah. And, you know, whether or not they, and there's another species of owl, and whether or not they, which one they give dominance to and actually keep or kind of perch. So it's definitely worth looking into.
Yeah, we have a lot of power in the choices. We have outsized power. There's also local land trust and conservation orgs. So that's another route you could go here.
Yeah, you can get your hands in the dirt and do some like habitat restoration work like I used to do in Carkeek Park.
Yeah, yeah, totally. It's really, depending on where you live, it's probably your mileage will vary a little bit, but do some like Googling and you may be surprised just how many folks around you would love your hands, a rake, an hour of your time on a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is leaning into native and natural choices when it comes to our own spaces. So like for rural folks like Alyssa and I, consider how more diverse alternatives to plain old grass can offer. So much to local pollinators and insects, which in turn provide benefits all the way up the food chain, right?
Yeah, I mean, I have a yard that is like mixed grass. I don't even know what the other stuff is.
Yeah, you've got like a lot of scrubby stuff in there. I think you've got some mosses in there too. And when we say plain old grass, we do mean that like classic colonizer, single monoculture, you're poisoning your yard so nothing else grows but this grass, you're over fertilizing it so nothing else grows but this grass type lawn. Like, that is what we're talking
about. Embrace the dandelions, friends.
Embrace the dandelions. Embrace the mixture of grasses. Like, this is great stuff for your local environment.
And, like, if you're somebody that doesn't like, yes, embrace the dandelions. I'm super allergic to dandelions, so I understand this.
Oh, yeah.
You can also go through and, like, let them bloom and then just pull them out, right?
Yeah.
Like,
there's no need to bring poison into the equation.
Yep.
There's lots of handy tools if you can't, like, bend down and do it. There's ones where you can just, like, lightly step on a tool and it pops them right out.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It's some labor, but that's part of being a steward, right?
Yes.
It's not just pouring some poison on something and walking away.
Yep.
Yeah. And for urban livers, for those deep in the concrete jungles,
mm-hmm.
even in small spaces and window planters,
mm-hmm.
choosing to plant something helpful, mm-hmm. something that should be native, even if you're up five stories, is a simple way to add a little mindfulness to what you're bringing to your block.
Most definitely.
Yeah, so as you start to incorporate new aspects to your path, like this familiars, and weave them together, like along with your sigils, so sigils and familiars, say.
Sure.
How might you go about that? Are you thinking maybe crafting sigils to represent an animal or something along those lines?
Yeah, I've been like thinking along about this all along the journey. A sigil for a specific animal has come to mind. And I'll add to that to, you know, sigils which are specific to a unique aspect of that animal.
Ooh,
so like
okay.
The watchfulness of the owl, the grace of the deer.
Very nice.
These could be a cool way to connect a lesson from that particular familiar with an intention of my own.
Mm-hmm.
But then like the flip side of that, which I did a little bit of during my sigil creation, was building out a visual dictionary of sorts, which includes animal symbolism in imagery. And this is where my doodling has been going in particular, to represent specific ideas and qualities. So symbols that represent that like observance of the owl, but that's just a symbol. And then that is a piece of a broader sigil.
Okay.
So these sigils would then be incorporated into any number of sigils, as it's just like one word from my sigil dictionary or symbol dictionary. And they may or may not have to do anything with familiars, the actual sigil. But this is where the idea via the image is precisely the programming that like I'm looking 100%. For visually, a bit of that like visual software code.
Yeah, it's that. We are definitely hacking the brain there. That's great. You know, you mentioned this is really just first steps into familiars. And we've talked a lot about this as a group, but are there any next steps you think you would come naturally when you're ready for that like next spiral deeper? Or does that still kind of feel like a mystery?
It's a little mysterious, I think, honestly, in the way the animals themselves are a little mysterious, too.
Very good.
This topic really is about taking the time to observe worlds and lives of creatures with points of view we will truly never know fluently, right? Like, we come up with a lot of anthropomorphized metaphors, comparisons, and we use that to help make sense of it all and appreciate lessons to be found. But, like, I don't know what it's like to be a fledgling learning to fly. Like,
no,
I don't understand.
I don't think we get to embrace that as
going
humans.
Through Carl's brain as he sees me through
that's
the window.
That's not sure much is going through Carl's brain.
It was definitely a couple capital words. I know that. What those words were, I'm not sure.
Food, now, mom,
exactly.
Dad.
I think, you know, that said, my final meditation in Tarot Pole, I think that kind of gave me some food for thought here. So, like, that Eight of Cups to dig deeper. I want to dig deeper in how species interact and connect.
Mm-hmm.
So not just the familiars and how their sort
in
of
silos,
solo
yeah.
siloed lives live, but like what are the systems that they are a part of?
Yeah.
Thinking about that more richly. The magician, sharing and spreading the word. So that could be a way to go deeper. It's
yeah.
more than just learning about these creatures.
Start
it's about advocate. Sharing it and bringing it into community, taking learning and turning it into acting as a keeper of knowledge and wisdom to connect to the pillars. So like those two cards in particular spoke to like potential next steps of going deeper with familiars. And I don't know, if I do turn this into a year-long topic, I'll probably go one of those two routes if I want to go from 101 to 201, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those additional critters showing up and the sort of resulting pivots and shifts in your journey offered you at least one surprising challenge, I would say. Did you hit anything else that you totally didn't expect?
I suppose I didn't expect the best approach here to be so minimalistic.
Mm.
Like, I really went into this topic expecting to need to do tons of reading and research, to go to specific locations, to basically become like an amateur naturalist.
Yeah.
And
maybe like at the far ends of these levels, right?
Yeah. You know, what I discovered was like the animal world was ready to teach me plenty of things which could be clear and meaningful without any of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most importantly, this was really a topic about leveling up my mindfulness. So being open and letting my instincts pay attention and absorb the signals and details around without any expectations shaping those signals, right? Just, you know, picking up on things that were just waiting to be noticed and appreciated. And especially when life in the world right now is so demanding of us and asking us to multitask and constantly be shifting our focus, this was really, really lovely to prioritize.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, really, like, yeah. what's more anti-capitalist than spending your time just drinking in the beauty of nature? No login or subscription required. So for this full moon, I offer you my process. here on how I pursued this Familiars 101 topic for those wishing to do the same. The animal world is amazing, but can be intimidating and full of literal rabbit holes. So a light little structure can go a long way when getting your learning started and looking for how to connect your new knowledge with your witchy ways and workings. So step one, be observant and open. If I learned anything from my experience with this topic, it's that even with the nature of my own backyard, staying open to the kinds of creatures I could learn from, the kinds of lessons they might teach me, was a valuable stance to have here. Stay open to what you've never noticed before. Allow your senses and instincts to show you what's really going on. This is a great opportunity to lean into that fundamental of mindfulness. For millennia before we humans relied on not just being observant, but instinctively understanding what we were observing around us, you know, from weather to plants to animal behavior, even the behavior of other humans, our survival depended on mindfulness. This is a skill set that's deeply set in our bones and in our brains. But that's not to say it's a super easy light switch to just like flip on. There's some digging out we've got to do to get there, some retraining, some renormalizing of this kind of a state of mind. To help with that, I highly recommend Wild Science and Star Paths by Tristan Gooley. It is a super helpful book for your familiar's observations, giving you signs and signals that he highlights to illuminate dozens of helpful windows into better understanding the natural world and its amazing inhabitants. I also recommend the Merlin Bird ID mobile app for deciphering bird songs and calls around you. Step two, internalize, meditate. This is where we start taking all those mundane data points and funneling it through your instinctive and witchy filters. On a regular basis, step away from your observations to sit with it all and ask meaningful questions. And they don't have to be complex questions. They just have to mean something to you. For me, I did this through regular meditations and journaling, and even a bit of doodling as I considered meaningful imagery and symbolism. This is an important step. It is what will give you the space to not just appreciate what you're learning and noticing, but to personalize what it means to you. How can what you see in these creatures provide valuable lessons or wisdom you yourself might take away? What values or virtues do these animals align with from your point of view? Everyone's going to have their own flavor here. You know, I might see an owl as a symbol of stealth and efficiency, while you might care most about how observant and persistent they are. Let your witch within start to speak to you here. Step three, incorporate. Once you've got your observations down and have spent that quality time internalizing, it should be a fairly natural conclusion now to start incorporating what you've learned and discovered into your craft, into your practice, and your mundane life choices. I'll give you a couple examples here. Language expansion. Your notes and meditations will likely be building out your vocabulary, in so much as words which represent certain creatures and aspects of them. Build these new words into your invocations, your spells, your rituals, to connect with these creatures via the language of your craft. Imagery and symbolism. Especially if you've been doodling, like I did, connect to animals via imagery and symbolism. This could be especially meaningful if you like to work with sigils. Imagery provides a medium beyond language to connect your ideas here into spells and rituals in your everyday life. Then there's method expansion. Learning about familiars could evolve how you conduct your practice, such as physically where you go to connect with certain energies or concepts, or how you do various witchy workings, such as the materials you use, the sounds you evoke, even the movements you embody. And finally, on the mundane and practical side, this is about improved stewardship for these creatures and their habitats. And perhaps most visibly, and to anyone not in your witchy circle of trust, this learning should absolutely evolve your choices in how you can improve your stewardship for the survival and thriving of the familiars around you and of the land and flora which they rely on every day, evolving that season to season. So I hope my light process provides just enough structure to lean upon here while leaving plenty of space to personalize, stay open, and enjoy tapping into the animal kingdom around you. Now go grab your notebook, sit back, and exercise that hardest skill of all, patience. that wraps up our full moon focus episode on familiars. We'll be back again just before the new moon for our next new moon brew featuring Ash's third subject, tarot. We'll also bring you more from Charting the Celestial Resistance Radio and share some updates on our creative projects we've been pursuing this year.
In the meantime, you're always welcome to spend time in community with us in our monthly Sunday Havens and in our Discord server.
And join us on Patreon for the newsletter and behind-the-scenes podcast fun. And on social media, where we're doing our best to shine light on our favorite creators, educators, and activists.
And until next time,
keep your world witchy.
Bye.